Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on communism and the labour movement during the Cold War. Both Mark Ahrens and Bob Carr make welcome returns to the Sydney Institute. As I recall, Mark Ahrens spoke for us on the war crimes legislation about a decade ago, and Bob Carr's been here on a number of occasions. They're well known to everyone, so I'll introduce them briefly. Mark Ahrens is a former broadcaster and documentary producer, a journalist who's written for many magazines and newspapers. From 1996 to 2007, he was a senior advisor to the New South Wales Labor Government, specialising in environment and climate change matters. And, of course, he's an author, most recently, of The Family File. And Janet Grundy's got some copies of Mark Ahrens' book, The Family File, on the Ahrens family here tonight. And Bob Carr is a former journalist, a politician, a long-serving Labor Premier of New South Wales, I think the longest consecutive Premier in New South Wales, and now, of course, in business, but also an author. And we're going to lead off on our discussion on communism and the labour movement during the Cold War with Mark Ahrens, and then Bob Carr will comment. By then, we'll have got through about 30 minutes. We'll have questions and discussion and finish at 7 o'clock. Mark Ahrens, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard. 50 years ago, right around the country, trade union and Labour Party meetings were frequently bitterly divided. Often denunciations would ring out around such meetings and fingers would point at commos and groupers. There were competing narratives or claims, if you like, on the one hand, that the Communist Party of Australia, the CPA, had infiltrated the ALP in order to subvert it. And on the other, that the unseen hand, as it was often put, of Bob Santamaria's National Civic Council, the NCC, secretly worked in the ALP to mould it along the principles of the, quote, reactionary Catholic Church. Now, there was considerable truth to such accusations, although it has to be acknowledged with the passing of history that both sides tended to exaggerate the extent and effectiveness of the clandestine operations run by these organisations, which, it should be stressed, were prescribed by the ALP, the CPA from its inception in 1920, and the NCC in the wake of the Labour split of the mid-1950s. Most of the heated focus at such meetings was on the position in the trade unions, with the right accusing the left of running on unity tickets with communists, and the left lambasting the right for collaborating with groupers to defeat good labour men under the guise of fighting the commos. These bitter feuds reflected differences on political, social, and economic issues. The left tended to focus on the depredations, as they saw it, of capitalism and Western imperialism. They advocated for the ALP to implement its socialist objective when it was in office, despite the differences that there were within the ALP left about whether or not it was a Marxist or social democratic model of socialism that they were arguing in favour of. They also tended to advocate a very militant use of trade unions, tactics that were, if you like, aimed to raise rank-and-file consciousness about the need to replace capitalism with socialism. On the other side, the right was, to put it mildly, rather cool on the socialist objective. They supported Western democracy, viewed the world largely through the prism of anti-communism, both in Australia and internationally, supported the conciliation and arbitration commissions system and thought that strikes should be only used as a last resort and never for any political or overt political ends. I think from the vantage point of 2011, it's rather hard to understand the passion that there was inside the labour movement half a century ago. Today, there's almost no ideological debate of any real substance within the labour movement. This, of course, reflects the collapse of socialism, both the social democratic and Marxist-Leninist models. But to start at the beginning, the CPA was formed in 1920 with a theoretical and practical framework that rigidly conformed to the Soviet Communist parties. Stalin's rise in the late 20s in particular, or from the late 20s, led to the Stalinization of the international communist movement, and of course the CPA here in Australia was not excluded from that process. It was basically on the political fringe until the Depression invigorated it. In the early to mid-30s, membership grew, mainly due to militant activism, especially amongst rank-and-file unionists. And after 1935, this militant activism paid dividends in a series of union elections. The CPA won a very powerful position in the union movement in the mining, maritime, engineering, steel manufacturing, clerical unions, to name just a few. It has to be stressed, I think, as a matter of historical record, that this was achieved through the hard work and organisational capacity of talented unionists who'd flocked to the CPA in despair during the Depression at the collapse of unionism. Another very major factor in the CPA's success was its disciplined, focused, even at times ruthless organising tactics. Now, right from the very beginning of the CPA, the ALP was hostile to it, and its success from the mid-1930s onwards in the trade unions issued a very stark challenge to the ALP, in which the unions had more or less a controlling influence since the great conscription debates of 1916-17. If a competitor party controlled many trade unions, it could logically, therefore, impact upon the very nature of the ALP itself. Now, the CPA fluctuated in its attitude towards the ALP. Sometimes it approached the Labour Party and asked for affiliation, and even on one occasion for amalgamation. But fundamentally, it denounced the Labour Party as a two-class party committed to reformism, not to revolution. Starting somewhere in the first half of the 1930s, but building particularly from the middle of the 30s, the CPA started to gain significant support within the ALP. And slowly a system of dual membership evolved, in which ALP members hid allegiance to the CPA in order to attain positions of influence. The most celebrated example of this would be the Clerks Union official Jack Hughes, who, when he joined the CPA in the middle 30s, was accepted but told that he was to stay in the ALP and fight for communist policies and positions. Now, from my point of view, I think it's important to stress that the real communist position towards the Labour Party wasn't that it wanted to go inside the Labour Party in order to subvert it, so much as it wanted to win the mass of workers away from reformism and to the banner of revolutionary Marxism-Leninism. And by 1945, the CPA believed it could actually achieve this. Its powerful position in unions convinced the CPA that it was winning the fight against reformism. And it had some good reason to believe that. In 1945, it either directly controlled or indirectly influenced around half of the union movement. And, for example, at the 1945 ACTU Congress, there was a left majority on the floor of around 90 delegates. However, The CPA's overconfidence led to disaster. After the war, Stalin ordered communists worldwide to take another ultra-leftist offensive. The CPA responded by leading a series of strikes in which they had many legitimate victories, industrial victories. But contradictorily, and with some irony indeed, its support base rapidly shrank as a result of the industrial offensive between 1946 and 1949. And of course, the crowning disaster for the CPA was the 1949 coal strike, which, rather than culminating in the victory of revolution and calling the working class to support a Marxist-Leninist banner, led to the utter victory of reformism, as the CPA would have seen it. Now, 1949 was also the year the CPA's union base began to unravel. And there's a little bit of interesting history here, in as much as in late 1945, the communists gained a really important insight into the forces that were being marshalled against them. When a copy of Bob Santa Maria's ultra-secret report to the September 1945 Bishops' Conference was leaked to them, almost certainly by a dissident Catholic. Santa Maria's report revealed the Church had backed the founding of a disciplined national organisation that was, quote, modelled completely on the Communist Party and which will work on the same principles of organisation. Santa Maria's 1945 report confirmed that it was official Church policy to use the ALP as a vehicle to defeat Communist power in the unions, using Bob Santa Maria's movement. After careful investigation, the CPA concluded the leaked document was genuine and published extracts in a famous pamphlet called Catholic Action at Work. And what that meant was that the dynamic that really dominated the Australian labour movement for the next four decades was now out in the public. It was in the open. Between 1945 and 1955, the major forces within the labour movement were aligned perfectly against the CPA, with the industrial groups being formed in 1945 and working very closely with San Maria's movement to win a string of union elections, hence the term grouper. The CPA, during this time, was reduced to its core of union power, mainly in the maritime, transport, engineering, manufacturing and construction industries. In this period, it declined from about 20,000 members at its peak to 5,000. Its remaining union bastions were under challenge, even siege, from the forces of the groups and the movement. However, in 1954-55, there was a dramatic change in the forces that had been aligned against the CPA. To understand this dramatic change, it has to be said that the federal ALP leader, Bert Everett, had worked extremely closely with Santa Maria and his forces against the CPA between 1951 and 54. As our host tonight, Gerard Henderson, revealed in his book, Mr. Santa Maria and the Bishops, by 1952, Santa Maria believed he could turn the ALP into a Catholic party, based on his conception of a rural-based society governed by Catholic social doctrines. It should be said that Everett apparently cared little for that, or about whether that happened. He just wanted to be Prime Minister. And so he entered into a very unlikely understanding. If Santa Maria delivered the Catholic vote at the 1954 election, he could control the win control of the ALP and implement Catholic policy. However, 1954 didn't turn out the way everyone expected, and the roots of this went back to Everett's time as Australia's External Affairs Minister. In April 1954, Vladimir Petrov defected and Menzies set up the Royal Commission into Soviet Espionage. ASIO, of course, had been formed in 1949 because decryption of Soviet codes revealed a spy ring, including operating in the Department of External Affairs. The Petrov affair destroyed Evett's chances at the poll, and he became absorbed in trying to prove that the affair was concocted by Menzies and Asio. This, of course, shattered Evett's relationship with Santa Maria, who was accused of plotting to take over the ALP. Evett ensured that the industrial groups were disbanded, and he turned to the left of the Labour Party and generally for support. The ALP split of 1955, of course, was not just a simple left-right divide. The right itself was bitterly divided between Santa Maria's line that a new party was required and, if you like, a stay-in-and-fight faction of those who shared Santa Maria's anti-communism but didn't want to hand the ALP over to the left. So, for example, in New South Wales, very senior anti-communist unionists like AWU Federal Secretary Tom Doherty worked closely with the left, including even suspected communists in the Labour Party, in order to promote the Evett case and to fight Santa Maria. The result of this great split, of course, is now well known. The Labour Party lost Victoria in Queensland, where Santa Maria had his main strongholds, but retained New South Wales, at least for another decade. The left won the party in Victoria, while the right retained New South Wales. This whole development provided a major springboard for CPA recovery. Over following years, it slowly shored up its union base and made minor comebacks by developing unity tickets with the ALP left, assisted on occasions by the secret influence of people whose real loyalty lay with the CPA. The communists' consolidation was, however, rather short-lived. First of all, the Sino-Soviet dispute precipitated a bitter split. In 1964, a group of hardline Stalinists left the CPA, taking a number of key union leaders with them. And then, from the mid-1960s, while a new CPA leadership was declaring independence from Moscow and embracing Alexander Dubček's socialism with a human face, Moscow was setting around not only to crushing the Prague Spring, but in its aftermath to creating a third communist party, a pro-Soviet communist party in Australia, which in its turn took a very significant section of remaining CPA officials. Now, ironically, and there isn't time to go into this in any great detail as I'm fast running out of time, it was during this period when the CPA's influence in the labour movement was waning that it did some of its most creative and perhaps even enduring work. To name a few, the Green Bands movement, the Indigenous movement, including the Gurindji and land rights campaigns, the feminist movement, and international solidarity, including the anti-apartheid movement and solidarity with East Timor. As a footnote to this broad sweep of history that I've tried to give you this evening, it's interesting to note that the split with the pro-Soviet minority in the CPA brought into being a very strange alliance between the ALP right in New South Wales and the pro-Moscow Socialist Party, or SPA. For example, John Ducker proclaimed the new pro-Soviet SPAR as the genuine Marxists. He wanted to undermine Green Bands by courting the pro-Moscow Building Workers Industrial Union, and over several years this assisted in the destruction of the builders' labourers' leadership and thereby the end, for a while at least, of the Green Bands. It's interesting to also note that Ducker used a number of dual ALP-SPA members to defeat the mainstream steering committee in a series of ALP ballots, directing right-wing support to SPA-supported candidates rather than CPA-supported candidates. So what was the wash-up of all of this? By the early 1980s, Santa Maria had concluded that the problem was no longer simply communists in unions, but unions per se, And so, in their turn, the splitters split. The result of that was that, against the bitter opposition of the left, four key NCC-controlled unions in Victoria returned to the ALP, which in Victoria reverted to the pre-1955 split situation in which, largely, the right has been the dominant faction. The collapse of communism on the mirror side of this, between 1989 and 1991, occurred after most CPA union officials had retired. The forces by then that had brought a powerful communist presence into the labour movement from the mid-1930s were utterly exhausted. And so, in a return again of the wheel, most were replaced by ALP left officials, and the union movement went back to its traditional position, in which the main division is again between the ALP right and left factions. Thank you.
Gee, this is extraordinary. This is, we're a group of people in the heart of Sydney reflecting 60 years after the event on things that were so passionately real to the Australians of the 40s, the 50s, the early 60s. The things we're talking about tonight were the most important things in the lives of, for example, a committed member of the Communist Party of Australia who was seeking to have a socialist Australia, a workers' Australia, a member of the movement, perhaps a member of the National Civic Council, who was beginning to become infected with the notion of small rural landholders and building Catholic political action to prevent a Stalinist Australia. And their battleground, very largely, was this sprawling entity, this sprawling invention of the 1890s, this ramshackle improvised entity, the Australian Labor Party. These ideological battles being fought out because Labor was a trade union party, not a social democratic party, but a trade union party, where 70% of the delegates at the conferences that met in town halls, state conferences of the ALP, came out of the trade union movement. Unions that would be controlled by a Communist Party secretary or by a committed opponent of communists who may have been a member of the Santa Marian movement. This was something, a conflict that occupied the living thoughts of Australians of that era. And now it's faded. I joined the Australian Labor Party, a little branch called Malabar South Matraville Branch. I met in a primary school at Malabar when I was 15 in 1963. The events we're talking about today are as far from us as something happening in 1903 would have been to me as a 15-year-old joining Malabar Branch. And it's nice just to reflect on the tricks and the distortions of history. What happened in that cataclysmic split of the 1950s, I think, is explained by some standout factors to me. One is, and we're indebted to Mark for writing what might have been at times a painful account of his family's history. We're indebted to Mark for making it very clear that the Communist Party we're talking about was absolutely wedded to the Soviet Union, so much so, and read his book, it's fascinating, this is part of the history I'm trying to summon up, so much so that he, in one episode, I haven't got it open in front of me, there was a car arrived in the backyard of the family home at Fairfield, loaded with Australian currency, but sent by a Romanian trade union on instructions from Moscow to keep the Communist Party of Australia going as an entity. It was bolstered with funds handed out from... Now, if I said there's another context, the Labor Party could have said, car must have been influenced by Santa Maria, but this is the truth of the matter. It was a Stalinist party in that it was taking money from Moscow, and Mark is absolutely candid and clear-eyed about this as well. In the 1940s, through a mysterious figure called Wally Clayton, it was embedded in Soviet espionage activities in Australia. And from Mark and from other sources, we know that those activities were significant. There were communist spies in the Department of Foreign Affairs in Canberra. They were getting material to the KGB representative in Sydney in his guise as a TASS correspondent. He had an office at King's Cross. And there were members of the Australian Communist Party helping the process along. One of them was a figure in Australian literature, Catherine Susanna Pritchard. There are others as well. And this is significant, and the most important part of Mark's book is the account of his late father sitting down with Wally Clayton with a tape recorder. The tape was nearly lost, it's a fascinating story, and getting Wally to more or less admit that he is a member of the CPA, Communist Party of Australia, was linked into espionage for the Soviet Embassy. It was a very important part of Australian history because it represents a vindication of the Petrov Commission and suggests that Menzies, perhaps against all his instincts, was not an opportunist. In fact, was more right than wrong in what he said about Soviet espionage in Australia. Labour historians, Labour-inclined historians, are wrong to say the Petrov Commission was a creation, a manipulation by Menzies. Menzies certainly would not have regretted it, but not even he could have expected the Labour Party to have played the issue so appallingly as Dr. Everett did. It was a Marxist-Leninist party, which means there was no democracy within the Communist Party, and it was very influential. All the histories, no matter what side they come from, point to the significant degree of communist leadership of the Australian trade union movement, reaching a peak in 1945, but continuing in strategic industries long after that. So you're looking at a different era, something that Australians now can't envisage. The Communist Party was very powerful. It was a Marxist-Leninist party, no democracy within the party. It was a Stalinist party in the sense it was wedded to leadership from Moscow. Moscow was the source of power, of instructions and control. And by 1945, and Marx said this tonight, it could believe it was winning the battle for the support of the working class with the Australian Labour Party. Frank Hardy wrote a propagandistic novel, Power Without Glory. And there's a little conversation in the novel. It was pure CP propaganda out of this period. But a very compelling novel. I take Hardy seriously as a writer. A little conversation between someone coaching a young recruit and the communist is saying to the young recruit, the day will come when all the workers will support the Communist Party. And the Labour Party becomes the party of reaction. The Conservative parties will no longer exist. Well, a moment's thought suggests what lunacy, what fantasy this was, as if the bourgeoisie, to use Marxist terminology, in the eastern suburbs of Sydney or on the leafy North Shore, would say, well, that's it. The Australian Labour Party is the party for us. As the old Conservative certainties fade away, we've got to get out there and support Everett and Caldwell, battle off the communists. It was fantasy, but that was the old world, the old Australia I'm trying to summon up tonight. A different world, one hard for us to imagine. And the Labour Party was the battleground for both this communist bid for power and a certain Catholic reaction to it. Now, we've got here tonight the expert, Gerard Henderson, on the Santa Marian phenomenon, his ambiguous relationships with aspects of the church, their ambiguous relationships with him. Gerard's reminded me that the Santa Maria did not control those anti-Everett Labour members of the House of Representatives who Everett took on, and therefore the split was avoidable. Santa Maria wasn't pulling those levers within the Labour Party, and Everett drove those people out and rent his party asunder entirely unnecessarily. I'll come to what it says about leadership in a moment, but this is what the whole episode says about the Australian Labour Party. Robert Murray, in his book The Split, was very, very astute in summoning up this era. I recommend it to you. He talks at the start of the book about what The Split says about the nature of the Labour Party. He says the Labour Party in the 1950s looked like a party not at home with its era. He said, the human failings of nostalgia and pique. This reminds me of attitudes I picked up as a kid. Kid in short pants, listening to the old members at branch meetings. The human failures of nostalgia and pique. Now, someone at a branch meeting would say, he said, just like the workers, we do everything for them. They become little capitalists. They don't vote for us. Remember at a branch meeting in that Malabar primary school classroom reflecting on the 1963 election defeat? There was one person with a non-English speaking background, who's Yugoslav, in the branch. And the others were saying, it's hard to win. It's hard to win. You can walk through parts of Sydney these days, not hear a word of English spoken. The idea that migrants were coming in. In fact, the migrants were overwhelmingly supporting the Labour Party. But and then the Yugoslav guy, Ned Gerdevic, in the branch said, they're brainwashed to do it. They're brainwashed to do it. They come here, they think there's only the party of Menzies. I mean, Murray sums it up. A party of nostalgia and pique. Les Halen, a colourful member for Parks, said after the Labour defeat in the 1963 election, he said, young people don't support us. He said, they've been corrupted by ridiculous images, they've been corrupted by rock and roll and soda pop. He said, inebriated by soda pop and rock and roll, they're madly pro-American. And in fact, pique and nostalgia collects it quite accurately. And Robert Murray goes on in his book, he said, the party despised intellectuality and doctrines and believed in the efficacy of feeling in the pit of the stomach for social reform. It was a party without doctrine, famously Labour, the party without doctrine. But being without an ideology itself, or even a coherent set of ideas, the Australian Labour Party was prey to intrusion by those who did have doctrines. The Marxists coming in from the left, and in patches, not to be overstated, the Santa Maria forces trying to work up a reaction and to capture the Labour Party sort of aspects of Catholic social doctrine. Murray goes on, he said, the occasional penetration of new ideas, mostly from the left, but occasionally from the right, was apt to have a more damaging effect than it deserved because of the hollowness at the centre. The moderate base, the AWU people, the people in cabinet in the old New South Wales and Queensland, the Victorian Labour governments of those years, didn't have an ideology of their own. It's not as if they were social democrats who knew that they were fighting for social reform, maybe a Marxist vision, but imbued with democracy, and on the other hand, fighting against Marxism-Leninism, because their forebears had been on the street of Berlin doing just that. They didn't have that ideological commitment. They weren't social democrats. They were, Murray gets it right. He says, Australian Labour's style, and those of us who spent lives in the institution would have this echo with us, Australian Labour's style was overwhelmingly rhetorical and emotional. Rhetorical and emotional. I remember a state Labour Party conference where Arthur Augustus Caldwell, leader of the party from 1960 and the demise of Evatt, through to Whitlam in 1967, said, he stood up elected in the town hall, he said, we are Labour because we are Australian, and Australian because we are Labour. And we roared. We loved it. Used to sum up images of Curtin and Caldwell and Fisher, and we stand with Britain for the last man and the last shilling, and everything, every bit of Labour mythology. And so that is a beautiful way of putting it. The Labour style was rhetorical and emotional. A party, he goes on, it was a party for the people, of words and passion, not careful thought, of conformity in the name of unity rather than original ideas. Unlike the best ordered of the world's electorally successful social democratic parties, you could be thinking at that time about the Swedish social democrats, the Israeli Labour Party, the Austrian Socialist Party, now named the Social Democrats, or the Germans, Dutch, great parties of Europe. He said, unlike those, it had little ability to absorb intellectuality into the social forces driving it. I think very true words about the ALP. So the Communist Party ended up having more of a resonance in the ALP than it would otherwise have done. And this is a problem. And again, some silly people criticising a review I wrote in The Spectator of Marx's book, said, you know, Carr praises the book. Carr praises the book for revealing that there were prominent Labour Party members of Parliament who had tickets in the Communist Party. Well, I think it is significant. It is significant because they never admitted it to it before. It is significant because Marx produced the ASIO documents that confirm it. And it is significant because it shows the weakness of the ALP left. It shows the failure of an indigenous or nativist left in Australia. Take Dr. Jim Cairns. Dr. Jim Cairns, I read his speeches as a kid. I was very excited when he was appearing at the University of New South Wales ALP Club. I was going to listen to a celebrity in the roundhouse speak at lunchtime about Vietnam. It quickly became clear to me that Jim Cairns was taking all his material right out of the CPA. His line on Vietnam was that this is a civil war. No, not a civil war within Vietnam, but only a civil war within South Vietnam, which is preposterous. He could praise Mao, Stalin, Lenin as the leaders of world socialism. In one of his writings, he referred to the elimination of the landlord class of Eastern Europe. The elimination of a class? The elimination of a landlord class? This is a defence of gulags. This is a defence of mass graves. We now know this to be the case. That's the language he used. You would not find in Jim Cairns a criticism of the Marxist-Leninist position. And I think he was a simple man, and ill-equipped for someone coming so close to the leadership of Australia. There are two things that I think would have been damned embarrassing for Australia, and that is Cairns somehow heading a Labour government at a time when the communist unions had locked Australia into a so-called nuclear-free southern hemisphere. Well, think about a nuclear-free southern hemisphere. What does that mean? That means that American ships, because Americans don't declare whether the ships are nuclear or not, are prevented from entering the southern hemisphere. It means the sort of crisis that had New Zealand out of its alliance with the US. That is, no US ships in our ports. That was rammed into ALP policy by the left in the early 60s. And the combination of that with a Cairns leadership of Australia, well, that's a troubling counter-history, alternative history. It didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Well, it's 95. It's 95, he might not be with us much longer. But I reckon we're in for a rewriting of his role in Australian history, and I'm referring to Edward Gough. People now forget what Whitlam's role was in the 60s. Whitlam's role was to stand up to the Victorian Central Executive of the ALP and say, well, you will not control this party. He was to defy Chamberlain, the National Secretary of the ALP, and to take him on. And he made it impossible for the party to expel him, as the left wanted to, because he kept going to Queensland and winning by-elections. Coming back and saying to the party, you kick me out, and there goes your chance of electoral success. And some dubious people controlling the Queensland ALP said, yes, he's right, and voted not to expel him when he was deputy leader. And I think as we contemplate the state of the Labour Party and the revelations that Mark has put on the record, we are required, one, to upgrade Whitlam's historic reputation, because before he did other things, he ended the control of large parts of the Australian Labour Party by left unionists who we now know, in many cases, had secret tickets in the Communist Party in their back pockets. This is part of Whitlam's role. I've written an obituary for the Weekend Australian about Whitlam's role. I concluded reviewing this, emphasising this part of his leadership that people had got it in the 60s when he took on the Cons, and saying Whitlam will be greeted as a hero of the left, but this was his most significant contribution in transforming the Labour Party by taking on the left. I sent a copy to Gough, who you might like to read the obituary. And on December the 2nd last year, I got a phone call. Mr. Whitlam would like to speak. I said to his researcher, I said, did he like the piece? He loved it. I'm putting him through, Bob. And it's December the 2nd, so the familiar voice. Hello, Bob. It's December the 2nd. It's my Austerlitz. I'll conclude by saying this. I think as we review this history, a vindication of Whitlam, a vindication of the New South Wales Labor right, because Mark very cheekily referred to my old boss, John Ducker's tactical playing with the post-Darwinist element in the Communist Party. He's right. Ducker had a lot of fun with it. I can give you more on that front, because I had fun with it undermining it as a little employee, a junior employee of the Labor Council. You're absolutely right. But overall, you've got to say, the New South Wales Labor right, so out of favour at this sorry hour, did earn its place in history. Did earn its place in history. By turning up at ALP conferences from 1955 and earlier, in fact, right through the 60s, into the 70s, voting down people who we now know had secret membership in the Communist Party, and saying, no, Arthur Geitzelt, you will not run the New South Wales ALP. And that was John Ducker's historic role. He can be very, very proud of it, and so can the New South Wales Labor right. Because without that moderate ballast in the Labor Party, in the mix of circumstances, the Jim Cairns, Arthur Geitzelt, Communist Party influenced and led and energised faction would have had enormous power. There's only one thing I'll throw in conclusion, and that is the whole Labor Party split represents a weakness of leadership. A political leader has got to be able to straddle differences. A political leader has got to be nimble-footed. Parnell was able to lead Irish nationalism by being an advocate of independence in Ireland and an advocate of home rule for Ireland when he was in the British Parliament. He straddled the irreconcilable. FDR was able to be acceptable to the white supremacists of the South and to the city machines like Tammany. He straddled the irreconcilable. That's part of leadership. It's tragedy for the Australian Labor Party in the 50s. We had Dr. Everett. Thank you.
Many thanks to Mark Ahrens and Bob Carr. We've got copies of Mark Ahrens' book. Janet Grundy's got them, The Family File, which is, Bob Carr said, is a fascinating account of a period of Labor War, L-A-B-O-U-R history, including the Communist Party, and I can only endorse those comments. Can I say thanks to Clayton Lynch for the use of this facility this evening? We've got till 7 o'clock, so we'll have some quick comments and some quick responses. I just wanted to lead off, firstly, with a bit of a flash for you, Mark. That Catholic document that was found its way into Catholic Action at Work, the Communist Party, which revealed Saint-Hermé's plans when the movement was still predominantly an organisation of the Catholic Church, was not handed to the Communist Party by a dissident Catholic. It was much more simple like that. There was a meeting than that. There was a meeting of the hierarchy in Sydney. Everyone was coming down by train overnight. Archbishop Dewick got on the train in Brisbane. Archbishop James Dewick, Catholic Archbishop of Brisbane, decided this was a top secret document. How would you look after it? You put it under your pillow, went to sleep, got up at Sydney Station, got out, left it there. And a Communist Party member of the Australian Railways Union gave it to the CPA. That's how it got there.
I'll have to revise your
understanding. Well, you can revise my understanding. That's my understanding. But when you do, Gough Whitlam is 95. Bob Saint-Hermé was still alive. He'd be 95 this year. He'd be 95 right now. What do you think he would have thought of your book? I would have thought he would have agreed with much of it. But you correct me. Okay.
Well, on the Dewick story, which is a very, very fascinating story, and was one that I think was very, very much pushed by Bob Saint-Hermé around the movement and the National Civic Council. I did quite a lot of research on this issue because it sounded unbelievable to me. To use Bob's words when you were finishing your comments, it would be too good to be true. So I actually tracked down the Communist Party official who obtained the document and interviewed him at some length. He was at the time a senior official of the Victorian branch of the Communist Party. He was in Melbourne one day when a man wandered in and handed him the document with, in his memory, it absolutely coming from within the Catholic Church. And it was somebody who he believed was opposed to the overt politicisation of the Catholic Church by the establishment of a political movement that was directed by the bishops. It's a fascinating historical debate, and Duhigg versus Jack Blake, who was the official who received this, is something that we'll probably never be able to nail down with exactitude, but I have very deep scepticism about the Duhigg argument. In terms of Bob Santa Maria and what he might have thought about my book, Bob and I, when I was a young man, did not exactly see eye to eye, and he used to attack me very virulently in his point of view and in various articles that he wrote in Newsweekly. But as I think you are saying, Gerard, if he were alive today and read an account where I have tried my level best to straddle my affection for and loyalties to family with the truth, I think that he would be quite amazed and quite pleased. Yes.
He'd be proud of you, Mark.
Now, you're going to give me a very bad name, Mark.
Question there. Yep.
The fact that Malcolm Fraser is now a hero of the left probably would support your thesis that ideology is dead in Australia. But don't events at the Victorian ALP conference on the weekend indicate that, in fact, ideology isn't dead and simply that the points of reference have changed?
Mark?
No, I don't. I didn't exactly see that there was an ideological debate going on at the Victorian Labour Conference. I might have missed something. What I saw was that there were practical policy issues, such as same-sex marriage, that the left wanted to debate, and the right didn't want to debate, so they walked out. It was a simple tactical manoeuvre. It wasn't something that was motivated by deep ideology. Certainly parts of the right, particularly the Shop Distributive and Allied Employees Association, still being very powerfully associated with Catholic doctrine, probably didn't want to have that debate for that reason. But I saw it more as a tactical manoeuvre than both by the left to try and get it up as a debate at a conference ahead of the national conference later in the year, and by the right just to stymie that.
Mark, just stay there. Yeah, okay. So, there's a question over there.
The history is fascinating, but where are the survivors of the CBA and their ideological genetic heirs politically today?
So the question is, where are the survivors of the Communist Party and their heirs today?
Well, there aren't many survivors of the Communist Party. People of my generation are about the youngest, and I'm about to hit 60. There are maybe a few who are a bit younger. I guess they fall into various categories. Some of them have remained absolutely loyal to the original ideal to the very, very bitter end and beyond. And indeed, the pro-Soviet group, the Socialist Party of Australia, when the official Communist Party was wound up in 1991, I think it was, very quickly grabbed back control of the name. But they are a dwindling and ageing group whose profile is probably well over 75 on average. And they have absolutely no influence, really, in the labour movement. Others, such as myself, have joined the Labour Party. And as Gerard said, I served in Bob Carr's government as an advisor to his Environment Minister and Attorney General, and am proud of the amazing record, particularly in the environment, that Bob led in his 10 years of being Premier. And others have joined the Greens, where some of them exercise a quite significant influence, and, if you like, replicating factional battles that rather remind me of the Soviet split in the Communist Party of
1968-71. What about the
heirs?
What about the ideological...
What about the ideological heirs?
I don't think there are any ideological heirs. Maybe there are some academics who still preach Marxist political economy in universities, but they are increasingly marginalised and, in my view, irrelevant because they have not come to terms with the shambles that socialism was and the realities of what have to be faced up to by those of us who are on the left.
Question here.
I just want to ask, how much knowledge did the CPA have of the Stalinist purges, and if they did have that knowledge on hand, to what extent did they conceal that?
The question is, how much knowledge did the CPA have of the Stalinist purges, and if they knew about it, how much did they conceal it?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. There's no doubt at all, and many, many anti-communists and communists in the 1930s had information about the purges, about the Gulag, and about Stalin's crime. So it was, on one level, a don't know, don't want to know. It was also, I think, as my father would have put it, many communists made up their minds, particularly in the Depression, that capitalism was a vile system and was finished and had no future. And having made up their mind that they weren't about to change it because of evidence of criminal behaviour, which was justified in Marxist-Leninist theory by the dictatorship of the proletariat, which meant that you had to crush the class enemies. And as long as someone could be shown to be a class enemy, well, they probably were getting what they deserved. So I think it wasn't a case of intelligent people not knowing the facts, not suspecting at the very, very least what the facts were, but rationalising it within an ideological framework. And certainly when Khrushchev denounced Stalin's crimes at the 1956 Communist Party Congress in Moscow and went on revealing more and more over the next 5 or 6 years, parties like the CPA had an enormous struggle to come to terms with what that meant. And many, many of them not only never came to terms with it, but justified it. For example, those who were pro-Maoist in the 1960s and onwards often were fond of quoting what Mao said about Stalin, that you couldn't make an omelette without cracking eggs. So, you know, there were many people who were just totally realistic and believed in what had happened as part of this glorious march from socialism to the highest stage of human development, communism. You know, it was messianic in many, many respects.
So we've got a question there, then we've got a question here, and I think Stuart will be the last. So, yeah. And just speak up a fraction.
As someone who grew up in a Catholic DLP family in the 50s and 60s in Melbourne, it's always occurred to me that the stock in trade image of, what Carl was saying, stock in trade image of people who, in the Labor split that went with Santa Maria, or he wasn't really the key figure anyway, were always that they were sort of ghettoised Catholics. And I don't recall the Catholic social action things of smaller retreats or anything like that that Rob Sanford used to bang on about. It was always about opposing Stalinism, therefore supporting the community to Vietnam, opposing communism, and state aid had its tools. But what I want to ask is, to what extent did Sanford make it easier for the Communist Party and the left by giving that stigma to the those who were grouped as those that left the Labour Party, as if they were just a sort of Catholic ghetto with simplistic ideas.
Look, I agree emphatically with that view. I think Santa Maria was altogether a negative influence on this. I can't accept a benign, upbeat view of Santa Maria here. He made it harder for homegrown, what I might call homegrown Labourist anti-communists, to win people to their viewpoint. You look at the way Alan Reid, read that among the books I'll recommend. I'd like to recommend half a dozen books if I can get a chance before we close on this, but you read that recent book, that biography of Alan Reid by Ross Fitzgerald. It quotes Reid's writing that portrayed Santa Maria as a very exotic influence, and he became a figure of disdain. And to people like Paul Keating, who had a father who stayed in the Labour Party branches in Western Sydney, fighting comms, Santa Maria was altogether a bad influence. He made it harder for anti-communists in the Labour Party, indigenous anti-communists, nativist Labour people, to defend their position and fight off the left. And I won't accept the sort of happy view of Santa Maria as a cheerful warrior here, and Jim McClellan going and having mutual deathbed reconciliations. I thought it was altogether in bad taste. And you see, but your vision is right. The people who were driven out of the Labour Party by Evatt's mad leadership, by his colossal failure of leadership, were people who were instinctively Labour. They wanted to go and supporting Labour. They weren't driven by a Santa Maria vision of the world. They thought it was a reasonable thing that we ought to move towards state aid for non-state schools, although in the 50s they weren't pushing that dogmatically, but they wanted some movement on that front and would respond to it when Menzies offered it. They wanted the Labour Party to be open to it. I think it's the most deft way of putting it. They wanted the Labour Party to be open to that, and they didn't like the idea of comms running the Labour Party. And without Santa Maria, the vision I've got, the vision a lot of people had in the 50s, of an indigenously anti-communist social democratic party, a Labour Party, an authentic Labour Party, would have been a fighting proposition.
Just stay up here, Matthew, because it's quicker. That book is co-authored by Ross Fitzgerald and Stephen Holt. So there's a question here.
I've often wondered the rationale behind and the effects of the Waterside workers' union's embargo on shipping to Indonesia during the Indonesia's flight for freedom. That probably becomes a long story.
Yes.
The rationale behind the embargo by the Waterside Workers' Union of Australia on shipping strategic, I suppose would be the modern day word, strategic materials in Indonesia.
Okay, so it's a question about the WWF's embargo on shipping to Indonesia.
Well, I'll be very, very brief about it. I think it just fitted into the post-war plan that Moscow had about how communists should be behaving. Anti-colonial struggles were at the forefront worldwide. They were seen as potential struggles where new socialist states could be created. There had been an indigenous Indonesian Communist Party for quite some years that had connections with the Australian Party, and it was only natural that a communist-led union would be engaged in that type of anti-colonial struggle.
Now we're running out of time, so I think the final question down there. Yeah.
Hey, Mark, I'd be fascinated to hear your reaction to the comments that have appeared in the press recently as to Doc Emmett's role in the Soviet espionage of the period leading up to the Petrov Royal Commission, and the views that have been expressed by various partisans in the probably Australian principally over the last few weeks and months.
But before we go to that, I think both Mark Ahrens and Bob Carr have discussed this issue about espionage in Australia, so perhaps if we give final comments on that issue, we'll start with Mark.
Sure. I mean, look, the only person who has really seriously suggested, as I have read the material, that Doc Evatt might have been a witting or unwitting Soviet agent is a very respected historian, Des Ball, who co-authored the groundbreaking expose of Wally Clayton's spy ring in Australia. I don't think in the material that I've read that he has put a convincing case as of now that would indict Evatt. It's one of those historical, if you like, mysteries that we'll probably never get exactly to the bottom of, but as I see it, I would entirely exculpate Evatt from that and convict him of some other things.
Yeah, no evidence. There's simply no evidence that Evatt was a Soviet agent. I think we can discard that. I think you can say there were people on his staff who were Communist Party sympathisers. And I think you can say he showed a shocking naivety. One of the lowest points for the Labour Party in the 50s was the parliamentary debate on reception of the Petrov Royal Commission report. And Evatt stood up speaking for the Australian Labour Party, 1957, said to the, Evatt stood up speaking for the Australian Labour Party, and he declared that there was in fact no Soviet espionage in Australia. He had written a letter to the Soviet Foreign Minister, Mr. Molotov, and he received this reply. And the reply confirms absolute assurance. And apparently you could hear the crash of Labour heads on the desks as they beat themselves. They realised what Evatt leadership meant. So a naivety, and people like Alan Dalziel on his staff. I believe Dr. Evatt was a disaster as Australian Labor leader and a nimble-footed Labor leader in the 1950s, a somewhat younger version of Whitlam or a Joe Carl at the federal level, could have saved the Labor Party from an entirely unnecessary split by declaring the Australian Labor Party was anti-communist and separating Labor from any games with the Santamarian forces, uniting the centre and presenting it as an anti-communist but social democratic party.
Many thanks. Look, I'll be very brief. I think it's been a fascinating night and very informative, also witty, a great night. So I just remind you once again, Mark Aron's book, The Family File, which led to this discussion tonight, is I think one of the most significant books in Australian political history, certainly in the last 10 to 20 years. It's great that Mark could come along tonight and talk about it. It's great that Bob Carr, a long-standing premier in New South Wales, could come along too and share their thoughts and ideas and recollections. So well done to both of you, and no doubt we'll see both of you back here sometime in the future.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.